what are we going to do tomorrow when I wake up and it's just me and like a limited earnings guy and an unpaid intern? And we've got football going. We've got other fall sports coming. There's 41 teams at Harvard, almost every single team trained in the weight room at that point. And we hadn't even started classes yet. And it was already nuts. It was one of those, you're either going to figure this out moments, or you can pack your bags and go do something else for a living.
Coaches, this podcast is sponsored by Samson Equipment. They have been providing elite strength training equipment and professional weight room solutions since 1976. If you value high quality products, great customer service, and a company with integrity, make Samson Equipment your go-to. Visit them at www.samsonequipment.com. That's S-A-M-S-O-N equipment.com. And let them know that the Talking Shop podcast sent you. Dan Perlmutter, welcome to the Talking Shop podcast. How are you doing today? And tell me something good that's going on in your life.
Doing awesome. Something good's going on in my life. My oldest daughter came in a lift this morning. She does cross country track and field and equestrian. And Wednesdays is one of her morning lifts in here. So we had the family workout going at 8 o'clock. It was awesome.
Heck yeah. Daddy daughter lifts. That's great.
Yep.
So Dan is the director of Olympic sports performance at Duke, directly in charge of baseball and men's soccer. This is year 16. Spent 5 years before at Harvard. Yep. And we connected when we played at Duke a few weeks ago. We even connected before that in the fall when one of the assistant baseball coaches at Northwestern came from Duke and just connected us. So super nice guy. He's been super sharing of his time, very insightful. He's done a lot of cool things. He got to Duke at the Marcus Stroman era. It's funny, some of my current players were asking you about more recent Duke guys that I'd never heard of. And then I hop in and I go, what about Marcus Stroman? But super nice guy. He knows a bunch of stuff. Really enjoyed kind of getting to chat with him. So I asked him to be on TSP. Couldn't speak highly enough. So I guess we will get into it. So I have a feeling slash I hope the story is one that you've already told. But what is the kind of biggest fork in the road moment that kind of looking back in your career, if you had gone left instead of right in that moment, kind of this would all be very, very different?
Yeah. You know, I feel like there's been a few of those even before I got into the strength conditioning world. There were a couple, I think probably the, you know, big moments, and I'll talk later about, you know, I don't really believe in big moments. I just think there's moments, but when there's tipping point stuff, and tipping points tend to lead to cascade effects. So I think that just the decision to abandon what I thought I wanted to do before this field and get into this field was a biggie. And you know, everything that I've been able to be a part of since then, in and out of the strength and conditioning world, has been, you know, directly related to that decision to kind of take the plunge into this world. I would say within the field, probably the biggest one was when I was at Harvard in 2008, at the end of 2008, my director and I both had interviews in the same week at different places, and he got his offer first. I got my offer at Duke second, and he decided to go. So I was fortunate enough to be able to choose between two offers. I was offered the head position at Harvard. I'd been the assistant director. And then I was also offered the head Olympic position at Duke. So, you know, we don't oftentimes in our world get those kinds of things at the same time. And it was a big decision to move the family. I had a 3-year-old and an 8-month-old, both daughters at the time. My family was 5 minutes from where we were living when we were up in Massachusetts. So big decision to leave Mass, take the Duke position. And I think there's absolutely been kind of a domino effect and a cascade effect of doing that, where, you know, it was choosing between kind of having my own shop at Harvard and trying to build that, versus having kind of a smaller shop at Duke within a big shop, but then also trying to build that out. And that was one of the things that they tasked me with coming down here, was to really build out the Olympic sports department. And over the last decade and a half, we've been able to do that. Gotten a ton of support, gotten a ton of inspiration from folks around here, but it really is just kind of unrecognizable compared to what it looked like when we got here.
What did you want to do before this field? And then second follow-up would be, how long slash what was that thought process between like getting the offer for both and like making that decision? Because this is a, I don't know if high turnover field, but people move probably more often in this field than other fields. So like, if you could just share a little bit about that process, like you kind of chatted about, you know, like, do I want to build here? Do I want to build there? But there's obviously a lot more that goes into it.
Yeah. Well, for the first part, coming out of undergrad, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I was a communications major, history minor, you know, two fields that give you a lot of cool info about lots of stuff, but no clear direction of what to do with any of the info.
Yeah. Very general.
Yeah, I considered law school. I was working at a law firm for about a year, year and a half, coming right out of undergrad, working as a paralegal, just trying to decide if I wanted to be in that world. Hated every single minute of it.
Classic.
I was pretty good at it. It was basically organizational skills. Then the paralegals had to manage the lawyers. So I was pretty good at it, but I was just miserable in that kind of office day job type of thing. So I came back to my alma mater, GW, and I was working in student activities, and I really enjoyed being back on campus and really just kind of liked being in that high energy college environment with college students. I think it's one of the most exciting times in people's lives. They're kind of figuring out who they're going to be, figuring out what they're going to do. And just to be able to kind of be connected to that in any way was awesome. But it was still office work, and I was just, you know, constantly trying to get over the boredom of the office stuff. I wanted to be getting my hands dirty. I wanted to be active. I wanted to be more physical. So I got into personal training on the side and then realized, you know, this is, you're talking basically 99, 2000 now. I started to realize that there was a possibility to do something related to that as a career. And so my fiance and then wife at the time, we decided to take the plunge and move from DC, go down to Florida, take a year, just work and figure out grad school. She was in a different field, but we were able to find our way to graduate programs that were in our passionate space at the same school. And so we got really lucky there. We went back to moved back up from Florida to Massachusetts to Springfield College. And from Springfield, everything again, just I've mentioned the kind of cascade effect, but using all the resources there and all the awesome people there has made everything possible for me since, you know, starting there in 2002.
And then what all goes into not only the vision, but, you know, you mentioned that you had kids at the time and then moving across the country away from family. So like, if someone is in a similar spot, kind of what do you think are those big checklist questions beyond just like cooler logo, more money, better opportunity? Like what all kind of went into that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I've never been someone that's chased a logo or chased a brand. I ultimately consider myself a helper. I mean, I think at the heart of what we do, we are helpers. Right. And everybody's kind of got their own definition of like what strength and conditioning is, what a strength and conditioning coach is or a sports performance coach. I think at the end of the day, we're helpers. Right. So I think I was looking for a place where I could have a big impact helping people. And I was having an impact at Harvard. Awesome kids, high achievers, really, really talented, very underappreciated sports programs there. Part of it is just because of the, you know, the kind of stereotype of the Ivy Leagues, but also a lot of those teams just kind of fly under the radar in terms of quality, but just the quality of people there was amazing. But to be able to kind of expand the scope of the impact that I could have and help people and then help build something up at a place like Duke, which has a very similar type of student athlete, but the impact that the sports programs can have nationally, you know, at the conference level and the national level competitively with the same type of student athlete is pretty awesome. So those were things that came into play on the professional side. On the personal side, I made really good connections when I came down here for my interview. I just felt like I clicked with the folks here. The place felt awesome. I really go with my gut on things like this, and then I'll make checklists of, to kind of like confirm or deny the gut. But all of my checklists tended to confirm the gut feelings that I had about the people down here. And that includes the student athletes that I was able to meet when I came. On the really personal side, on the family side, I think a lot of times in our field, we can kind of have the tendency to, in our own minds, make decisions about jobs before we have really valued our spouses and our family's input. And I knew that I'd already kind of gotten that lesson from peers and friends in the field, fortunately, before I got in that scenario where I was choosing between Duke and Harvard. So I was able to have that light bulb pop up and say, hey, this has got to be a family decision. It can't be a you decision, and then you're trying to convince your family that it's the right decision. And Amy, my wife, was super supportive. The girls were really young, so they didn't have a ton of input. But my family, who I'd been living close to again for a few years, was really supportive as well. Meaning my folks and my siblings and grandparents and those kinds of folks. They really understood that the impact that I would be able to have at a place like Duke, just in the broader scheme of things, was probably going to be a better chance for me to be able to help people at a really high level than it was when I was at Harvard.
How many days went by from that first offer to you waking up and being like, I think Duke is it?
I think it was probably about a week, and I think that was very intentional. I do things intentionally, or I try to. I have my gut instinct in reacting to things, but then I make a point to be really intentional in following up that gut instinct. So I think it was about a week when it comes to negotiations and family discussions, and really just waking up every morning and feeling just as excited or even more excited about it than I was when I was down here in Durham for the interview. I also think, to Duke's credit, they were really supportive of Amy in the process. They brought us down here again, just the two of us, before my start date, just so that we could hang out in Durham. She could get a chance to meet folks, make sure that she was comfortable with the move. And that speaks, volumes to how much they care about, people's families here. And I think everybody says that to some degree, right? We're in a family kind of field, and but the people here were really, really supportive of her as well. And I think that made a big impact on us in terms of decision making.
Yeah, for sure. Not only saying it, but showing it. So that's great. I'll pivot and ask you to share this story. When you ipso facto became the director of Duke, or sorry, not Duke, the Harvard director when your boss left, the interim director story. That was wild.
We didn't talk about that yet. 2004. I'd finished grad school. I was doing my kind of capstone field work working at Holy Cross in Worcester, Mass, which is halfway between Springfield College and Harvard. And I had already done an internship at Harvard, so I had a connection there. Got the offer to come in as an assistant coach. They only had two full-time people at that point, and the assistant was leaving for UNLV. So the director, who was also a Springfield graduate, so we kind of had that pipeline together. Called me, asked me to come in for an interview, interviewed, got the job. So I started in 2004 in August. And about 2 weeks after I start, he gets an ACC men's basketball offer and leaves in the middle of football preseason. So that was absolutely a big moment. I actually had in my notes that that was going to be the answer to this one,
I
but
was
I knew that
hoping
we were going
so.
to get to it anyway.
Yeah.
So I decided to talk about the other one, but the oh crap moment of what are we going to do tomorrow when I wake up and it's just me and like a limited earnings guy and an unpaid intern. And we've got football going, we've got other fall sports coming. There's 41 teams at Harvard, almost every single team trained in the weight room at that point, and we hadn't even started classes yet, and it was already nuts. It was one of those, you're either going to figure this out moments, or you can pack your bags and go do something else for a living. And one that I didn't tell you about, which was, I'll even build on that, which is pretty cool.
Oh man.
The football team specifically was really supportive. Bottom line is, we do a national search. The person that we ended up hiring, Craig Fitzgerald, wasn't going to be able to start for a while. So they made me the interim director for several months. And just to keep that continuity of, you know, having, rather than bringing in a new person part-time or temporarily and then passing it off to Fitz. So I think that consistency helped when Fitz got there. And he and I had a really good connection when he interviewed for that director's job. So I think that made them comfortable and confident in just having me fill that interim role. But so you flash forward a few weeks, we get through preseason, we're getting ready for the first football game. The football team had a really specific pregame warmup that they would do every single game, no matter where they play. They've been doing it for years. Head guy had been there for a long time, and he really liked this one specific type of warmup. So we get to the first game of the year, and you know it's going to be on TV, and it's a big deal and all that. Absolutely hammering down rain. And O-line coach comes in to the weight room from the football offices a couple hours before kickoff and says, hey, Murph wants to change the warm-up. He doesn't want the guys lying down on the grass getting soaked before the game. So need you to come up with a new warm-up. So that was my secondary oh crap moment. Like, you got to figure this out or pack your bags and go do something else. And I'm going to give all credit to Ryan Fitzpatrick, who was the starting quarterback that year.
Jeez.
And was the captain, and or one of the captain. He and I connect before the game, meaning I basically run to the locker room and say, Fitz, we got to change the warm up. I'm not familiar with any warm ups other than what you guys have done that, you know, Sean, the previous director, had walked me through for the games. So I can either come up with something that's totally unfamiliar to the guys, which is going to be real herky jerky, and we're going to have cameras walking around and Coach Murph's going to get pissed off. Or you can help me and we can kind of like on the spot do modified versions of what we would be doing lying on the grass. This is the kind of level of nitty gritty that people in our field have to figure out every single day, and nobody outside our field ever sees it. You know, these are the kinds of like stress impact moments that we deal with all the time. Just having to figure something out on the fly, having to change something on the fly, having to adapt on the fly, that I think the best people in our field are really, really good at pivoting to really quickly. And it just means that you've done your homework, right? You know your science, you know your coaching, you know your people, you know your roster, you know your limitations, you know what you can't do, you know what you're good at doing. I was really young. I was really new in the field. And it was, all right, I'm going to jump in the fire and we're going to try this thing. And it's either going to work or it's not going to work. And you just have to be ready for whatever the consequences are on either side of the coin. You know what I mean? Fitz was a huge help. He, voice-wise, because I was really nervous, and maybe the guys didn't even see that, but I was super nervous. We got through the warm-up. We won the game. Everybody was fine. The warm-up was good. The game was good. But it was just one of those things where you've got to not just make a big decision, you've got to make a big decision really fast. And to me, those kinds of things are sometimes better because you don't have time to overthink stuff. You know, it just tests your ability to be able to adapt and pivot. And so I look back on moments like that, and moments like that, if, you know, I mentioned earlier, it's not really big moments. I think there's just a lot of moments, but moments like that are ones that I really appreciate. And I'm really thankful that I've had, you know, been able to experience in my career, because one of the things I told myself was, hey, you get through this, everything else can be easy.
Oh,
you
yeah.
Know what I mean? And it's going to make you, whether you believe in confidence or not, or, you know, just, you know, kind of feeling good about what you do and that kind of thing, it's going to give you confidence, or it's going to give you a foundation to make other decisions like that quickly, to be able to adapt to other things quickly, to be able to get through difficult things quickly. And it has been. That was one of the kind of scarier moments for me. And then I look back on it in retrospect and I'm like, yeah, there's been a lot of other tough things. And you know, that was one of them, but it wasn't really that tough.
I think it's all relative, you know, like okay. At that point in time, you know, like I told this story before. I had a sophomore in high school at my old job in the private side. We just spent like half the session, you know, talking. And I think for him, it was more just the routine of training and just being with like an older kind of like male figure than the actual training. But He was like, yeah, dude, my girlfriend and I broke up. You've been there since the beginning. We've been dating 4 months. But like, that's a big deal to him, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Different side story. But no, I think with the confidence piece, is that's kind of a buzzword in our field. I got this definition from Steve Bryanstein and Jeremy Boone, and kind of like in their leadership development stuff, it's like knowing you can get the job done, but how do you know you can get the job done if you've never done it before, right?
Yeah.
You'd never led a football warm up, you'd never been a director at the D1 level for that matter as well. But I think when you are prepared, at least mentally, like you used all your resources, you know, you brought in one of the players. If you're like principles based, you know, like it's not about the exercise, just to talk training. It's what category is it, right? It's a heavy bilateral squat. Well, that can look a bunch of different ways. Well, does it even have to be bilateral? I just need to get like a quad dominant knee bend in there. I need it to be somewhat relatively intense. But no, I think all of those moments give you those confidence because when you've done it before, then you know you can. But sometimes you just gotta be as prepared as possible.
Yeah.
And you'd like took a step back and asked, all right, well, what resources do I have here? And it all plays out. You didn't get rested on TV.
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you this too. And then there's two different things that I think are way better and way stronger than confidence. Because as I mentioned, I don't think I really believe that confidence is that important. I think as practitioners within the field, I think curiosity is way more important than confidence. Because curiosity, if you look through that lens every day, it's not just, hey, I'm interested in learning this, or I want to be a lifelong learner, which everybody says, right? Or I want to continue to develop, which everybody says. If you look through a lens every day that allows you to see the world where you're trying to figure things out, trying to figure out how to do something, trying to figure out whether the thing you're doing is the right thing or there's a better thing. If you're constantly searching for stuff, that's curiosity to me. And that part of the journey doesn't ever end, right? So if you get into a moment like that, part of the curiosity factor is you're curious about whether you can handle the moment, right? And I think even back, and I was probably, I don't know, 26, 27 or something at that point, I think I was, you know, if I think about that moment, I was really curious to see if I was able to be up to the moment, you know? And, you know, if you think about the kind of Navy SEAL mindset where, you know, you never rise to the occasion, you always fall back on your preparation, right? I think I was curious to see if I was prepared enough to handle that moment. That I didn't need to step up to the moment because it was just a warm up, right? That I don't think anyone would define that as a big thing, but the moment itself felt big. So if it feels big, are you prepared? Have you done the preparation to be ready for that moment? And I think the curiosity part was what kept me in it. I really wanted to see if I could do it. I wasn't going to run from it. I was curious to see if I could do it. I think when it comes to athletes, that's a big factor. But then I think you can also replace competitiveness, or you can sub that in for confidence. Confidence is really fleeting when you're not playing well. Competitiveness
for
can
sure.
be there all the time, right? And I think competitiveness is easier to fall back onto as something that you can use as a foundational thing if you're not very confident. Because you can always go out and see if you can play up to your standard of excellence or compete at a high level, even if you don't get the result you want. So I think the curiosity and the competitiveness allows you to focus on the right things because it's things that you have control over, as opposed to focusing on the wrong things, which are things you don't have control over. You don't have control over the outcome, right? Especially when you're playing against someone else. But you do have control over how you approach the moment. You do have control over whether you play as hard as you can play, whether you are mentally dialed in to the moment. That's under your control. And I think when you take care of those things as an athlete or us as a coach, I think the quote unquote big things take care of themselves.
For sure. Yeah. I think preparation is the common theme. And then as a coach, it's curiosity. And then as an athlete, it's the competitiveness, you know. And when I showed my age in the weight room asking about Marcus Stroman and not knowing about the other guys that the players were asking about, I asked like, when did Marcus become Marcus, you know? And then you said, he's always had that in him, you know? So I guess I'll ask one kind of training specific question. So when a guy that has the mentality already and a guy that has enough talent to get a scholarship to Duke, right?
Yeah.
Where do you fall into the development equation and helping better baseball players? Because the more I've done this, the more I realize that the sport is obviously way, way more important. And I can get them to squat and jump and sprint and do all these things. But it's like, if you can't handle being the bottom of the ninth, two outs, bases loaded, you know, or if you can't recognize a fastball versus a changeup versus a curveball, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll ask one training specific question. Like, looking back, where did you fall into his development equation when he already had a good baseball base and a good mindset?
Yeah, I think, you know, the joke I like to make is just try not to screw the guys up, right? They come in, they're really talented, good athletes. Try not to screw them up. And obviously that's a joke, because I think we can have a really big impact on anyone getting better, no matter where their starting point is when we get them, right? You know, Stroh had that stuff inside him as a competitor and as a talent from the time he was really young, right? That's what got him to Duke baseball. And as he developed as a Duke baseball player, that's what got him into the pros. Nothing's predetermined, you know, as an athlete, but he had a big chunk of that built in already. Doesn't mean that if he got to us here, we couldn't get him to there, right? I might get a lot of other freshmen or sophomores or whatever that are here, and they've got a lot more work to do to get to their college ceiling and then be able to build on that for their pro ceiling. But he just was closer in terms of ability level. He was more developed just as an athlete, multi-sport athlete, multi-position athlete in baseball. So I think he had a lot of those things already built in, but it didn't mean that there wasn't room for development. And I think the stuff with Marcus wasn't really any different than a lot of our other really talented young guys that get here. And, you know, an interesting kind of comparison point is really talented grad students that we get now, because with the portal being so big and, you know, especially in baseball where you might develop for several years, not get a ton of reps on the field, and then look for a place where you're actually going to start, right? We get a lot of grad school transfers that come for 1 year. Now we get guys that are really athletic, really talented, good competitors. And then my job is, okay, what else can we get from them physically and mentally in terms of performance to make them even better? Like, we don't want them to be the same level they were in their year four at their undergrad. We want them to be even better. So that's a really interesting challenge in a slightly different way, but in the same kind of arena, right? I think the answer is two part. Number one is that there's no easy answer, right? Which is the cheap answer too.
It depends.
But I really believe in this. I really believe in this in every part of the field. I think that you have to really get to know each athlete really, really well, because it allows, not just as an athlete, as a human being, right? Because everybody's got blind spots, whether it's a physical blind spot, a mental performance blind spot, an emotional blind spot. And what I mean by blind spot is just something they're not good at yet. The stuff that I helped Marcus get better at was different than the stuff that I helped Bryce Jarvis get better at. Bryce Jarvis was a, you know, first round pitcher for us. It's better than some of our really talented, or sorry, different than some of our really talented freshmen this year. Those things that I'm helping them get better at. Doesn't mean that there aren't certain exercises that are going to be important across the board, or certain types of training that won't be important across the board. But I think you have to get past that foundational stuff and figure out what each person's blind spots are. And then you got to kind of figure out how to drill in and help them with that. For one person, it might be what they think of as confidence and what we might see as just being grounded in the moment, right? They may be super talented. They may be super physical. The exit velo on the bat may be great. Their bat to ball speed might be great. Their, you know, foot speed, their arm strength might all be great, but they really struggle to stay in the moment in the batter's box. So does that mean that it's not my job to help them in the batter's box? No, I can absolutely help. I'm never going to take over from our hitting coach and what he does, because he's the expert in that arena. But it doesn't mean that I can't contribute a little bit by helping out in certain ways. I kind of look at that type of stuff as the crossroad between mental performance and physical development, right? We weave mental performance training into everything we do. It's not just that, like, all right, you got a couple sessions of mental performance every week, and then you got your physical stuff in the weight room and out on the field. No, it's the way that we look at our practices. It's the way that we think about our training. It's the breathing stuff that we have the guys do in all the different settings. It's the resets that we do physically and mentally. It's doing yoga. It's doing mental minutes with our mental health folks. It's all these different things that get woven into the physical development programs that change the way the guys approach those things and allow the guys to then figure out what their blind spots are, right? Figure out what they're not comfortable with, and then really, like, not just lean into the discomfort, like dive into it. Don't just go out and take, you know, a million ground balls off the fungo because that's what you love doing. Like, go work on something on the field that you're not good at yet that makes you really uncomfortable until it becomes as comfortable as taking ground balls off the fungo, you know, or come do extra stuff in the weight room because one particular movement out on the baseball field isn't a strong point for you yet, as opposed to just coming in and doing the stuff that you love when you get your extra time in here.
All makes sense to me. That's great. So next, the coolest slash craziest story. So the one that, like, looking back, you couldn't even make up if you tried in the already unique field that we're in.
Yeah. So I've got a cool one, which is not related to training at all. But, you know, I've heard coaches who retire in different sports and different parts of the field, you know, have the one liner about, you know, how it's not about the wins and losses, it's about how many weddings you get invited to, right? And I truly believe that, right? I think if you have an impact on people as a student athlete at the college level, you'll stay connected with them once they're done, whether they go professional in their sport or they go pro in a different field. You know, I'm still connected with folks that are in their 40s now that were some of my first athletes at Harvard that have kids that are like in junior high, which is crazy for me to think of. But I really try to make those deeper connections with the student athletes that go way beyond the weight room and way beyond the game field or the, you know, the court or the pool or whatever. So I think one of the coolest things that's happened so far in my field is I had two athletes at Duke that were dating at Duke and then were together after Duke and asked me to officiate their wedding.
Wow.
It didn't end up happening because of COVID. The format changed, but just the ask to me was, you know, whether you want to call it validation or fulfillment or just kind of a deep sense of gratitude of the connections that I've been able to make with folks and the impact that I've been able to have with some of the folks that I've coached. Getting that phone call with, like, them on the phone getting teared up and me tearing up and, like, their parents tearing up and, like, hey, all those things kind of coming full circle has been, you know, I mean, maybe that was one of the biggest moments of my career. I was trying to think of something professionally that went past that. You know, we've had some cool championships and, you know, cool stuff in games and cool impacts with people and training and just making, you know, progress and, like, someone who you didn't think would get it and then gets it in the weight room or whatever. Those things, you know, there's a lot of those, but realizing that you have the impact on multiple people to that degree, I think is really awesome.
Yeah, I call it the sports stories, you know, like,
yeah,
I had a pretty interesting kind of playing career myself, walking on to making it to the D2 World Series to having a nice little 4 years. And it's like, when I talk about that, I don't spit out stats.
Yeah.
I just talk about what it was like going from, like, redshirting to playing to kind of everything in between. So,
yeah.
You know, like, I'm sure that there are quantitatively some, like, crazy seasons and some crazy individual performances, but, like, you know, that's the story you chose to tell. So I think that's really what it's about. But I think the interesting part about that is, like, that took years and probably years to, like, for that to come to fruition, you know?
Yeah.
So you never know. Only time will tell. So you just do good stuff for a long time, and then hopefully you can kind of get that validation or fulfillment, or just know that you did have that impact.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I tell our younger coaches or talk to our interns about that are just starting in the field, is that from the beginning, they don't have to think about the really big stuff right away. Just really dial into the little stuff. Make those little connections with folks. You know, if your job as an intern in a workout is to give everybody a pound when they walk in the room, be the hype guy, coach up details, follow the lead of the head performance coach for that team, and really facilitate the quality of that workout. There are going to be tons of moments in that 60 minute session with that team where you can start to make little connections with the various athletes, right? And if you start to make those little connections, then those athletes seek you out for slightly bigger connections or a slightly bigger impact. And then they seek you out a ton. And then you become the point person that they seek out, you know? And then it gets to the point where when you're in a full-time position and you're really embedded with your team, meaning you're traveling with them, you're at practice, you're in and out of the locker room, you're making connections with them at the hotels, on the road trips, you're getting to know their parents and their sisters and their brothers and their cousins and their families, then you become a really important person in that athlete's life, especially when they're struggling with something. In the great moments, it's easy, right? The great moments are easy because everybody's rah-rah and everyone's positive. But if you have had those small connections with them that have gotten stronger and stronger and stronger, you're going to be the person that they seek out when they're really struggling with something. And oftentimes, that's the deepest impact you can have on an athlete, right? You may help them physically get to where they need to be a dominant player on their current team and have their draft stock go up and go on and have a great professional career. But what's going to resonate with them is the things that you help them with when they were struggling. You know, like I've sat in a waiting room at the ER with athletes at like 2 in the morning and just sitting there and being someone that was there when they were scared and they were going in to see a doc and, you know, not doing anything, just sitting there like on our phones or like, you know, hanging out, showing each other stupid Instagram videos, but like just being present right there and being willing and eager to help them in a moment like that, that resonates with folks down the line, you know? And then that expands the type of impact that your normal coaching has on them, right? It's not just that they're an easily coachable athlete. It's that they're looking for you for guidance in everything that they do. And then when you get that kind of impact, that brings a lot of responsibility to make sure that you're constantly modeling things the right way, that you're doing the right thing, you're being a good person, and that your stuff is in alignment with the head coach's stuff and that it falls within the culture of the program and the expectations of the program. So it's not an easy thing to do, but I think it's an unbelievably fulfilling way to kind of walk around every day in this field. You know, you'll get way more out of that than just focusing on sets and reps and programs and percentages and speeds and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what you said earlier about how the big moments aren't really moments, but like it is a moment, but it's the consequence of a bunch and a bunch and a bunch kind of before that.
Well, it's all perspective, right? Like something that feels like a big moment today, 20 years from now, when you got a little bit more perspective on it, might not feel like it was big at all. It just feels like one thing in a kind of cascade of events, right? But I think the nice thing about flipping that coin on its head is like every moment's big, right? Don't just hope that you're going to run onto the field in the dog pile at the national championship for whatever sport you coach and that you spend all year just hoping for that moment. But in my opinion, that's like the worst way to operate in our field. I think if you feel like every moment that you're able to have a connection with your teams and your athletes is a big moment, or that they're all just evenly big, they're all equally important, then you'll really, really revel in that quote unquote big one in the dog pile, but you won't have wasted the whole year focusing on something that is very unlikely to happen, if we're being honest, right? I've heard head coaches in a lot of sports talk about winning national titles, and as soon as the dog pile's done, they're really depressed. They're depressed partly because they're not going to be able to hang out with their athletes for several months because everyone's going home.
Yeah.
But a lot of them, you know, when I've talked to folks like that or heard stories from coaches like that, they realized that the whole year building up to that, they were focused on the wrong thing and that they missed out on what could have been a lot of cooler stuff during the year, basically focusing on that process, right? And I think process has become so much of kind of a hashtag word at this point that we almost roll our eyes at it. But again, it goes back. If that's the lens that you look through every day, then every moment of the day is going to be important. And if every moment of the day is important to you, then you will really be present and you will really be where your feet are. And you're not going to waste any of the moments that you have when you get to go to work and get to hang out with your team.
Boom, mic drop. So last big question.
Sure.
I feel like we might have already kind of touched on it, but the biggest kind of full circle moment. So the one kind of like the one you just shared that like took some time to kind of realize how it was all connected and it all came together.
Yeah. Well, you know, maybe this is perfect. I'm going to circle back to what we opened with today. So my daughter was in working out. She's my oldest, senior in high school, final semester, getting ready to go away somewhere to college next year. We adopted her when she was 9 months old. She was a 10-week preemie baby. So tons of health problems from the prematurity. She was born with fetal alcohol syndrome. So her birth mother was addicted to alcohol, addicted to heroin, was on methadone, was smoking. So Mia's chances in life were very slim. She had an amazing care team at the PICU up in Massachusetts, the, pediatric ICU at the hospital she was born in. She had an amazing foster family for the first 9 months. And Amy and I were able to get connected with her while she was still living with the foster family and then formally start the adoption when she was 9 months old. And Mia was a kid who, even by 9 months, opportunities and outlook were very, very low. And at that point, for, you know, people with fetal alcohol syndrome, where that ends up going and what kind of limitations it places on your life in the future are kind of unknown. That kind of develops as you get older. So we didn't know if she was going to be globally delayed, if she was going to have, you know, kind of develop out of a lot of the initial stuff and just have really benign impacts from the FAS. But, you know, they were really severe at the beginning. She was extremely sick. We're talking 5 or 6 doctor's appointments a week for like the first few years of her life. Those things went from physical to psychological development issues to emotional stuff to social stuff. Her life has been really, really hard. And at the same time, she has been easily the most important person and thing in our lives. You know, we love all our kids equally, of course, but the types of stuff that she's had to overcome to get to where she is now, you know, she's a competitive 800 runner and cross country runner. She's won national titles in equestrian in several different disciplines. And to be able to go from where she started in life to really just kind of attacking each challenge, even as a little kid, to doing it with a smile, to leaning into pain and discomfort. It's all those kind of things that we kind of talk about with our athletes at this like big philosophical level. But when you go home every night and you are having to help somebody and see somebody help you as a parent figure out how to help them as a kid, even from a young age, that has just been woven into everything that I've done in my career. I don't separate those things at all. So, you know, whether her being in here this morning was any bigger or more important than any other morning that she's been in doing her stuff to get ready for her meet on Friday, or if it was just another chance for me able to be able to spend some time with her before she moves away from home in a few months. Those kinds of things have an impact on everything that I do at work. They have an impact on how I coach, how I talk to people, how I communicate, the perspective that I bring to work. I can't separate it from how I operate as a sports performance professional. I don't think I would have been able to accomplish the things that I've been fortunate enough to be able to be a part of here if Mia hadn't been a part of our lives from the moment she was, you know? So that to me, if you're looking for cool stories, our ability to be able to bring her into our family and just have her be a part of our lives from an early part of my career in this field, there's nothing that even comes close to that for me.
Jeez, that's awesome. Thank you very much for sharing.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Yeah, kind of crazy, like the stories that I would have had no idea, you know, and that's my favorite part about this podcast is like there's a plethora, an excessive amount of podcasts. Oh, how to squat more, how to do this, this, but it's like, you know, the thing that helps you be the best coach you can be is things like that. So yeah, very, very cool. Glad I was able to hear that for sure. And I'm sure something like that, you know, like because Ty has two young kids, you know, like I'm sure you and he probably chatted about being a dad over the last few years and stuff. So yeah, I think that's kind of the foundation for everything else. So super, super cool. So that is all I have for you today, sir. So I want to say thank you very much for making the time again, sharing your very cool stories and insights, and been doing really good stuff for a really long time. But now I want to open the floor up to you so you can plug whatever you got to plug and tell the listeners where they can get more of Coach Dan.
Sure. So I am of an age where I do not have a huge social media presence, at least comfort-wise, in terms of like doing a lot of what I do in the presence of social media. I'm on Instagram at the other Coach P, all lowercase. I do not post a ton of professional content because we have some awesome folks on our staff who post and share stuff from our department, just Duke Sports Performance. So you'll see stuff that I do and stuff that our staff and our, more importantly, our athletes do through the Duke Sports Performance Instagram page. Most of our stuff goes out through there. And then our teams at Duke really do a lot of stuff promoting the athletes and then the other departments, including ours. I am potentially getting into a podcast of my own that's not necessarily going to have anything to do with strength and conditioning. That may be starting up this summer. We just talked about it, one of the baseball players and I earlier this week. It's more going to be just kind of hanging out and talking about cool, dumb stuff with people that we want to hang out with. So you will absolutely get an invite and be one of the first people that we want on there.
Sweet.
And it'll touch back to sports. It'll touch back to kind of our world, but it's more going to be kind of a passion project of just having fun, spending time with folks that I don't get to see very often. So that's potentially in the works. And then I'm starting to get into more presenting and speaking at engagements at the kind of regional and national level. So looking for more of that in the next year or two. But I prefer connecting with folks one-on-one. I am happy to put my email and my cell number out and have people reach out and just talk shop. I love it. Don't have a ton of free time, but I will fill my free time with this kind of stuff because it's really, really valuable to me. So I'll get you that info and you can include it in whatever way you see fit. But I really welcome folks in every part of their life in the field, whether it's someone who's trying to figure out how to make the next step, whether it's someone who's a really seasoned professional who's just looking to connect with folks in other places. That to me makes this field so much more than work, right? The ability to do that for me, like I get the wow moment every day I walk in the door in the weight room here, every single day. I haven't had a day in my career where I haven't walked in the door and had the wow moment where I'm like, I actually get to come do this every day. I haven't worked a day in my life. And it's because of, being able to make connections like this and hang out and kind of share stories and just talk shop. So really appreciate you having me on.
Awesome, awesome. So I think you should for sure do that podcast, and I'd be happy to offer my insights. This will be episode 167 or 168. You know, I started back in 2019. It's just like I call it like a personal ho or a professional hobby. It's like relevant to my job, but also like what I want it to be. So I think you'd enjoy it a lot. But I'd be happy to chat through kind of the planning process and kind of flesh out some of your thoughts. But
Love it.
and to kind of touch on something you said, I think the chance to go shake someone's hand is exponentially going to leapfrog that connection beyond just 10 phone calls or 10 Zooms or whatever it may be, you know, so just the chance to spend a few hours with you, made a big difference. So I'm glad that I got to share this podcast and share it with everyone else. So, I'll get all those links and whatnot in the show notes below. And, thank you very much again. Good luck the rest of the spring, and hopefully I'll see you soon.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Good luck this weekend with your guys.